Thanks, Donnie. It's great to see you. We're already enjoying our time here. One of my wife's favorite trees is our red buds. So we ministered in southwestern Virginia for a long time. And so this is bringing back lots of good memories, dogwoods and red buds, and talking about hunting whitetail and seeing turkeys. And I almost hit one, a turkey, driving, and I thought, wow, I wish I could have gotten it. It's great to see Donnie and Jane again, and we've talked about doing this for years, off and on. So we're very thankful to be here. It's already been a great time, even though I haven't even had the privilege of being with you yet, because I got to see a nephew and a niece this afternoon who live in Franklin, and they teach at Hope. New Hope Christian School. So they've been there for 21 years teaching at that Christian school. So it was great to see my nephew and got to see the Opry, what do you call it? The Opry Hotel, is that the right term? Opryland Hotel. We had never seen that and wandered through the gardens before we had some lunch with them. So that place is amazing. I've never seen anything like that. So that was beautiful to be there and spend time with my nephew and his wife. Well, this evening, I wanted to tell you this first before we get into the topic of conflict resolution, just to encourage you as we get started. So the last 5 weeks six weeks have been a really busy time of traveling. And I've spoken in Virginia, South Dakota, Idaho, and now Tennessee in the last 6 weeks. And I just encourage you, the Lord is building his church. So, and I could tell you stories from each one of those locations of how the Lord is building his church. But that's one of the blessings of getting to travel and speak, is just seeing what the Lord is doing. So I'll just tell you one story just to encourage your heart. So last weekend I was speaking in Idaho, and there was a group there, a group of pastors, three men who have been for a number of years wanting to see biblical counseling introduced to the Boise area of Idaho, and in particular Meridian, which is a suburb of Boise, and it's one of the fastest growing areas in the United States because of all of those Californians that are fleeing the state of California, and one of the places they're going is the Boise area of Idaho. And so these men have had a vision for how do we introduce what's called the Treasure Valley of Idaho to biblical counseling, because it's a brand new concept there. So what you've probably heard for years, and you've heard about ACBC, and you've been taught about the heart, and you have a high view of Scripture, because of Donnie's faithful teaching of God's Word, that's all new to them. They have never heard any of those concepts. So they were praying for 75 people to come out to this introductory conference on biblical counseling, and instead of 75, we had 148, and they were praying for representatives from 12 churches in the area, and we ended up having 16 churches represented. So, and then this coming fall, they're going to have their first formal biblical counseling training. So last week was kind of plowing the ground and just introducing the whole area to what is biblical counseling. And then in this fall, they're going to start talking about that in detail and doing the 30 basic hours of training that ACBC provides. So, and I could tell you stories about every one of those areas. The church is alive and well. And I wanted to start off encouraging you, number one, because the topic we're going to talk about can be very discouraging, but also in the days we're living in with our culture, we feel a lot of cultural pressure, don't we? And it can you hear the news and just everything that's going on, whether it's the wall, the South, immigration and the wall, and all the nasty politics or all the moral issues that are going on in our country. It could be discouraging, but the Lord is working, and he's building his church. So I'm very thankful for that. Now back to conflict resolution. So as I stand before you this evening and we dig into this topic, This is not just an academic subject for me. As the director of a counseling center, I see broken relationships multiple times every day. So as I'm standing before you, I have couples going through my mind. I can think of the angry man who has been deceitful with his wife for years, and I'm thinking of a particular couple right now. And she left him probably 4 months ago. These are members of our church. She left him 4 months ago because he's such an abusive man with his mouth, and he's lied to her for years. And she took the kids and left. And I've been working with them for months and months, trying to get them reconciled. In fact, I was just texting with him this morning and encourage him to keep doing what the Lord has been teaching him that he needs to do. And I'll tell you more about that story later on. Or I have in mind the pastor and wife who we've been trying to get the wife to buy into counseling and in particular a mediation. And just last week, it was their 10th anniversary, but she didn't want to have anything to do with her husband on their 10th anniversary. Isn't that sad? So a pastor and wife, a man who's standing and proclaiming the Word of God, a graduate of a conservative seminary that you would know if I said the name, and here he and his wife have a very broken relationship to the point of just about a month and a half ago, they had a wrestling match, and they were wrestling each other on the floor. Or I'm thinking of another church leader in our town of Jacksonville. He's a well-known businessman in our area, and he and his extended family, he's a well-known church leader, and he's a well-known Christian businessman in our area, and his extended family relationships are a mess. Just this past week, 2 weeks ago, his son-in-law sent me 7 pages of email of accusations against his father-in-law, and the father, just last week, sent me a 21-page response to his son-in-law. And what we're doing is we're trying to work on a mediation to get all these people reconciled with one another. As the grandfather of 9 grandchildren, with the 10th on the way, I can't imagine what it's like to live their life because they have, I think, 5 grandchildren, and 3 of them they're not allowed to see. And that just breaks my heart as a grandfather to think, and all of these people are Christians. And in fact, the son-in-law is a student at another very well-known evangelical seminary, but their relationships are in a mess. So conflict is something that we have to deal with, like the slide says, conflict in everyday life. What I'd like you to do as you think about the 4 G's of conflict resolution, just to keep this practical, and I'll be weaving some stories through this material just so it doesn't feel like it's just academic. I want it to have a very real feel to it. But I'd like you to think, as we're getting started here, of a relationship where you're feeling some tension. So think of a relationship where you're feeling some tension. And as we go through each G of conflict resolution, ask yourself, okay, now how would that G apply to that relationship where I'm feeling tension? If you don't have anybody coming to your mind, you need to get down on your knees and have a worship service right now, because you might be the only person in the room that's not feeling any tension in a relationship. It's just part of living on a fallen planet with other fallen people, right? We feel tensions in our relationships. One of the key topics that, or the key themes that you're going to keep hearing throughout this evening and tomorrow morning, is that Christians are called to respond to conflict in a way that is remarkably different than the world. Let me say it again. We know how the world responds to conflict, right? Gossip, slander, nasty letters, broken relationships, anger, yelling at one another. That's all the common ways. Ignoring one another. That's the way the world responds to conflict, but if I'm reading the New Testament right, in particular, Christians are called to respond to conflict in a way that is remarkably different than the world. Now, I'm a teacher, so I want you to repeat that with me. Let me say it again for you. Christians are called to respond to conflict in a way that is remarkably different than the world. So say that with me. Ready? Christians are called to respond to conflict in a way that is remarkably different than the world. So what we've done here is we've put together a systematic approach of conflict resolution from a Christian perspective, from a Christian worldview. And if you're going to start from a biblical worldview, we always start with the first G, and that is you need to glorify God. So everything's about the glory of God. That first verse there, whether you eat or drink or, and don't miss the phrase, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. I'm going to show you another verse about that in just a moment. But think of how comprehensive that is, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink. So the Apostle Paul is starting with like the most mundane activities of life, eating, drinking. Whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, wouldn't that include conflict? Whatever you do, do it as an act of worship to God. Now, I know that sounds really strange, and each one of these G's is going to have a key question that goes with it, and the key question for this first one is going to be, how can I approach this conflict as an act of worship to God? Now, think of the beauty of that. As soon as I ask myself that question, the focus gets off the other person and how angry you are at the other person or how hurt you are at the other person and starts to direct your gaze back upward, and that has a reorienting effect for your life. One of the things that I'm trying to do with all these people that are in conflict that I deal with, and I could go on and on about stories about conflict that I've run. The last 2 years have been incredible years of dealing with conflicts and broken relationships. We're a church of about, we don't know how many thousand actually, somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 people. And we have a lot of people that are dealing with a lot of issues in their lives. And a common phrase for me as I've come home each day and from dealing with people is Rose will say, so what happened today in the counseling center? And I go, more drama and trauma. And that's just been my phrase the last 2 years, more drama and trauma, just broken relationship after broken relationship. And what I have to do is, because their focus is always on the other person, everybody comes into counseling with, counselor, please fix my spouse and help the idiot realize that I've been right all along. That's everybody's attitude. Is, counselor, you need to convince my spouse that what I've been telling the guy or what I've been telling her all these years has been right, and if they would just listen to me, we wouldn't have been in this conflict. Well, I have to help them get their focus off the other person and first of all get it upward to how do we approach this conflict as an act of worship, because whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. What I'm doing here is I'm just giving you an overview of the four G's so you get the flow of thought. And then we're going to go in a little bit deeper with each one. Notice, if you would, the progression of thought. So if I don't get my attitude right first, glorify God, but I start with number three and I move toward the other person to try to get reconciled and I try to move toward and get restored, how's that conversation going to go? That's probably not going to be a very healthy conversation, right? So if I don't get my orientation upward first, and then secondly, what have I contributed to the conflict? So the first question is, how do I approach this conflict as an act of worship to God? The second G is, what have I contributed to the conflict, and what do I need to do to make things right? Asking those two questions have a humbling effect, and it's amazing what humility will do when there's tensions in relationships. Let me just tell you a quick story to encourage you about that, because I want this to stay really, really practical and not just academic. And in the meantime, turn to Romans chapter 11, and we're going to look at, that's going to be the first place we turn in God's Word. Humility tears down walls. Pride builds up walls. Let me state that again, and you preach it to your soul. Humility tears down walls. Pride builds up walls. So humility might be, one of the many ways humility might be shown is you bite your tongue and you don't have to say something back, because it always takes two to fight. So if you bite your tongue, you just say, okay, I'm going to swallow it. I don't have to engage right now. I don't have to intensify this conversation. I'm just going to bite down. I tell people, here's one of my favorite lines I use in counseling, bite your tongue until it bleeds. Bite your tongue until it bleeds. Just clamp down. You don't have to respond. Humility tears down walls. Pride builds up walls. So here's a quick story. I was doing a mediation for a family. First of all, I helped a mom and dad and their daughter get reconciled. And the big issue between them is mom and dad didn't agree with the guy that she wanted. She was a 23-year-old. Mom and dad didn't agree with the guy she wanted to date and potential to marry. You ever heard that issue? I've heard that issue over and over. And so the daughter said, okay, I'll show you. And at Christmas time, because she knew it would hurt mom and dad, she moved out at Christmas time because she just wanted to send a message that I don't like you and I don't agree with you, so I'm leaving home. And so they had a broken relationship. And the first thing we did was a mediation between the mom and dad and the daughter, and it went beautifully. Everybody owned their sin. They got reconciled with each other. We had a beautiful day and a half of mediation helping them get reconciled with one another. Now, the tough one was the mom and dad and the boyfriend. There were really, really big walls built up between the mom and dad and the boyfriend, especially the dad and the boyfriend, and they had said a lot of really hateful things to each other. Lots and lots of bad emails had been exchanged. Email's not the way to do conflict resolution, if you haven't realized that already. Text messages aren't the way to do conflict resolution. Facebook messaging's not the way to do conflict resolution. Face-to-face, as personal as possible, is the way you do conflict resolution. And so the boyfriend had been counseled by some men that were mentoring him. Don't ever go back in the same room with that man. He's an angry man. He'd come to meet with me as I'm trying to get him ready for mediation, and I'm saying just the opposite. I'd say to him, Ephesians 4 says, endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Ephesians 4 also says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. You've let many suns go down on your anger between you and the father of your girlfriend. And then he'd go back to his mentors, and his mentors would say, nope, don't go in. Angry men don't change. Don't go in the same room with an angry man. So I didn't know if he was going to buy into the mediation or not. When I'd meet with him, it was always the father's fault. And then I'd give him homework about getting the log out of his own eye. We got up to about 2 weeks ahead of the mediation, the set date that we had for the mediation, and I wasn't sure he was going to show up or not. He's an airline pilot, and about 3 days before the mediation, he called me and he said, I'm going to come. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to trust the Lord with this, and I'll talk to him again before we walk into the mediation room. And we walked in. He came the day of the mediation. He actually rearranged his flight schedule to fly from Texas to Los Angeles to be there for the mediation. I prayed with him in my office, and I could tell a little bit about his attitude was changing. We walked into the mediation room, and the mom and dad had already agreed that part of our agenda would be to let him speak first because he wanted the parents wanted to be servants. And a whole other story is how the Lord changed the father's heart, and he was all ready to ask forgiveness for his anger. But the young man started, and instead of making accusations, the young man started confessing his sin. And I had this very nice agenda, and as a counselor, you know, I have a nice agenda planned, and he just blew my agenda out of the water, and he just started confessing sin and confessing sin and confessing sin, and 15 minutes into the mediation, they were up and hugging each other, and he's saying, will you forgive me? I was wrong to try to get your daughter to turn against you. Will you please forgive me? And the parents are saying, of course we'll forgive you. And 15 minutes into the mediation, we have tears and hugs. Well, that's what humility does. Humility tears down barriers. Pride builds up barriers. What I thought was going to be a day and a half mediation, actually, we were done in about 3.5 hours. Because every time an issue would come up that we thought we were going to have to discuss, the parents would say, nope, We don't need to talk about that anymore. He's already taken ownership. And then I'd say, well, what about the issue of? And he, nope, he's already taken ownership. So I surprised Rose that night. Typically, I would text her and say, I called it in Los Angeles. We lived up in the mountains. I would say, I'm coming up the hill or I'm coming home. And I usually text her to warn her that I was coming home or let her know I was coming home. Well, I thought I'm just going to surprise her because I was coming home early. And I walk in the door and she goes, wow, you're home early. And I said, yes, I just saw a miracle take place. I just saw the power of the gospel get unleashed as people got reconciled. And guess what? I don't even have to go back tomorrow. I had scheduled the whole day for a mediation and I don't even have to go back tomorrow. Christians are called to respond to conflict in a way that is remarkably different than the world. Third G, gently restore. Galatians 6 is about if you see a brother overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of meekness, gentleness. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. But that only comes after the first two G's, and then the fourth. The goal is always reconciliation. There are some people that are irreconcilable. There's a whole category in the Bible of being irreconcilable. So this isn't a magic formula that if you always follow the four G's, every relationship's going to be great. There's too much messiness and too much effect of sin in our lives for it to work perfectly. So this is not a formula of four G's and you'll always be reconciled. But as far as depends on you, live at peace with all men, Romans chapter 12. So let's dig into this with a little more detail with the first G. And see if I can get this to work. There we go. So there's the key questions again. Everything in life is to be done as an act of worship, and because we believe in the sovereignty of God, right? So we believe our God is absolutely over all. So there is absolutely nothing that happens in our lives that God goes, oops, I didn't see that coming. So one of the most encouraging things that I can say to you about conflict in your relationships or tensions, maybe the word conflict is too strong of a word, but I could say tensions in relationships, maybe one of the best things I could say to you is that nothing comes into your life unless it comes through the hand of God first. I have to believe that by reading the Bible that I read. Listen to Romans 11. This is my favorite verse in all the Bible. And I think I could make an argument that Romans 11, 33 to 36 is the grandest doxology in all of the Bible. Now, that's quite a statement because there's whole psalms that are doxologies, right? So why would I say Romans 11, 33 to 36 is the grandest doxology? It's because of the book that it's in and the context where Paul is, after 11 chapters of God's redemptive history, Paul can't contain himself anymore. And he says, oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. And he quotes Isaiah 40, which is my favorite chapter in the Bible. And, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, exclamation point. So I'm trying to read it right. Oh, not just the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. Paul's a worshiper. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. 11 chapters of God's redemptive history, and he just is breaking out in praise now. How unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord and who became his counselor or who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? And the answer to all those questions is no one, nothing. For from him, please don't miss it, for from him, so nothing comes into your life unless it comes through the hand of God first. For from him, through him, I can't get through this tension in the relationship. It's totally overwhelming. Through him and back to him are all things. That ought to remind you again of 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So how can I approach this conflict as an act of worship? To him be the glory forever. Amen. Now, remember again, just a quick comment about this. Remember again that there were no chapter divisions in the original. So it flows right into chapter 12. And what does he say? So I'm urging you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God that I've just presented to you in 11 chapters. Now you present your bodies a living holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. How can I approach this conflict as an act of worship? And then a little bit later on in chapter 12, he says, as far as depends on you, live at peace with all men. And so I believe what he's doing here is he's saying all of life is about worship because of God's redemptive plan. You're turned into a worshiper. Now, chapters 12 through the end of the book, how do you live as a worshiper? What does it mean in your relationships with one another to live as a worshiper of God? So, we won't take the time to look at Psalm 28, but that was a very meaningful passage for me early in ministry when I was going through an intense conflict as a pastor. And if you get the little booklet called Help, I'm in a Conflict, I tell a little bit of the story there of early in ministry and the conflict that I went through as a pastor. And this was one of the passages that the Lord used to just minister to me. So let's think about this, where he says everything is from him, through him, and to him, Romans 11:36. He's the source. Everything is out of him. So I have the prepositions up there in case you like that kind of thing, ek, di, and eis. Everything's out of him. Nothing is out of control. Everything is out of him. Everything's from him. He's the source. Everything's through him. I can do all things. That includes intense conflict. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Now, it may not feel like it humanly, and you go, I can't live in this marriage anymore. I don't know how to deal with this person anymore. Paul was in prison when he wrote that in Philippians 4. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And what do you have to do? You cling by faith to that the Lord is going to give me the strength I need for this relationship because I want to do it in a way that is going to glorify God instead of robbing glory from God. We're about to get in this, but I'll just plant a seed. Someone or something is going to get glorified during conflict. Another way of saying that is someone or something's going to get worshiped during conflict, and it's either going to be you and your wants and desires, or it's going to be God and what he wants and desires. And for his wants and desires to get glorified, guess what has to happen to my wants and desires? I've got to die to my wants and desires to say, okay, Lord, I'm going to do things your way. So everything's from him, everything's through him. And then he is the specific purpose of everything. It's ace is back to him. It's unto him. So I view life as everything is from him, through him, back to him. Jonathan Edwards is my favorite theologian. He's probably America's greatest theologian, and he said this is a life purpose verse. This is a verse that just defines what life's about. Think about it for a moment. If everything starts with him, he's from everything, and everything goes back to him, he's the culminating purpose of everything. Well, then that means that the dia in the middle, that he's the middle of everything, or the book of Revelation says that he's the Alpha and he's the Omega, he's the beginning and the end. Well, Paul's arguing here he's also the middle. So if he's the Alpha and Omega, or he's the source, the sustainer, and specific purpose, what is he? Everything. And that's exactly what Colossians 3 says, when Paul writes, Christ is all and in all. Or he writes, for me to live is Christ. Everything is about, okay, how do I live for the glory of God, even when I feel tensions in relationships? Now, can you see how that would just diffuse a lot of relationship issues? If you start doing the hard work, as the Puritans would say, take your soul to task. Take your soul to task. You got to preach truth to yourself. Okay, this isn't about me and my wants and my desires, and I'm going to just force my will on you. This is about what does God want and what's going to bring glory to him. And then that starts getting the needle of your life toward true north instead of what I think is true north in life. I have to get people to get their compass reoriented the right way. Everything in life is about the glory of God. So let's keep going. There are things, though, that rob God of his glory. I'm going to skip this slide just for the sake of time. If you get the book, The Peacemaker, or Peacemaking for Families, Peacemaking for Families by Ken Sande, S-A-N-D-E, that is the most used resource in our counseling center. We go through copies of that every week in the counseling center, Peacemaking for Families. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, someone or something is going to get glorified in conflict. We as humans are worshipers. We can't help but worship. We worship as naturally as we breathe. And we have wants and desires. And they're just, it's like my inner person is just pumping out wants and desires. And if I don't fight with my soul to glorify God, myself is just going to want to get glorified. It's going to just exalt itself. We'll look at James 4 in just a little bit, but James talks about that very clearly. What is the source of the wars and the conflicts that are in your midst? And he's talking to a congregation that was fighting with one another. Rich versus poor was one of the issues going on in the early church that James talks about. And he says very clearly that the source of the conflicts is the desires that are waging war in your members. We'll take a look at that in just a moment. But if I'm going to understand what robs God of his glory, I need to really understand what conflict is. So let's think of a biblical definition of conflict, and I have a word highlighted there on purpose. A difference in opinion or purpose that frustrates someone's goals or desires. Do you ever feel like you got in front of somebody's agenda? I felt sometimes even with other church leaders like I got run over by a train just because I said something contrary to what somebody else wanted. A difference in opinion or purpose that frustrates someone's goals or desires. I'm remembering in particular a conversation right now of I thought innocently said something in an elder meeting, and boy, did I get a reaction. And the thought that went through my brain was, wow, I feel like I just got hit by a locomotive, and I think I just found out somebody's agenda. And I got in the way of the agenda, and they were trying to get rid of me because I got in the way of the agenda. A difference in opinion or purpose that frustrates, I was frustrating the person, and that person had goals and desires. As soon as you start talking about desires in Scripture, you start getting into the realm of the heart. What's going on in my inner person? So let's think about this whole idea, and I'd like you to turn, you have a number of different verses, but I'd like you to turn to Matthew chapter 12, if you would. Some of this is in your notes, some is not in your notes, so if you're the kind of person that says, you got to follow the notes, every line and fill in every blank, I will already warn you, I am going to frustrate your goals and desires. So Matthew chapter 12, and we can do conflict resolution. We'll practice what we're learning. Again, I believe everything in life is about worship, and humans, as naturally as we breathe, attribute worth to things, and we end up fighting over things that we consider valuable, and we're going to drive our stake in the ground, but other people don't hold the same value to those things. So Matthew chapter 12 talks about this, and this is really about the heart. Notice what our Lord does in Matthew chapter 12. Of course, he's speaking to the Pharisees, and he's concerned about the fruit in their lives. And he says in verse 34, very famous verse, "You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak what is good? For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart." I know you know the verse. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So I say the things I do out of my inner person, the heart. Now here's why I chose these verses. Look at the next verse. And what the Lord does is he really helps us here, because he gives us a synonym in verse 35 for the word heart in 34. And I want you to tell me what it is. The good man out of his good treasure brings forth what is good. The evil man out of his evil treasure brings forth what is evil. So what word does the Lord switch in verse 35 for heart in verse 34? Treasure. I think that's packed full of meaning. You can tell what a person's value system is. Now, this whole idea of the heart, and people fight over the things they consider valuable. That's why we fight. This is something that's important to me. That's why I raise my voice. That's why a tear comes. That's why I get quiet. You're threatening something that's valuable to me, the treasures of the heart. Well, how can you tell the treasures of the heart? And I'll give you some formal definitions here in just a moment. But in essence, the heart biblically is your thought life, your emotions, what stirs your emotions, your decision making, how you spend your time, how you spend your money. So mind, will, emotions, and desires. They tell you about your desires. So next time that you're feeling frustrated with someone, ask yourself, so we're doing what the Puritans say, take your soul to task. Ask yourself, if you want to glorify God instead of glorifying self, ask yourself, okay, what treasure is being revealed by the way I'm responding to this conflict? What's my thought life? What's my thought life telling me that I value here? What is my decision making telling me that I'm valuing? What are my emotions? Why did I escalate over that? What is that telling me that I value? And then it's all tied together with the idea of the desires. What am I wanting? So a shortcut to get down here at the root system of why do people fight, and this is where I have to do the most work. People come into counseling with, you know, counselor, please teach me 4 communication principles just so we can learn to communicate better. And they don't understand that's not the way we work at the Grace Center for Biblical Counseling. Yes, we'll teach you 4 communication principles, but I want to do something even deeper. I want to teach you, why do you talk to people about things the way you talk to people? Like, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So what's your thought life tell you about your heart? What do your emotions tell you about your heart? And what are these telling you you are worshiping? So treasures are about worship, or the old English word, worth-ship. Well, that's priorities. People are willing to sacrifice. And another verse that ought to come to mind, probably came to mind already for you, is where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That's telling you the way you spend your time, the way you spend money is telling you about your value system. So one of my favorite statements theologically is one that you have in your notes. Just expect conflict. In fact, a theologian named George Zemek puts it this way: we're all living with a Genesis 3 hangover. I feel it every day of my life, the Genesis 3 hangover. I feel it in my body. I feel it in my relationships. Tensions in relationships are just part of living on a fallen planet with other fallen people. Now, why is that important? Because some people live life thinking, well, I'll just avoid all conflict. If this is true theologically, and the way you typically operate is, well, I just withdraw, and I get quiet, and I just pretend like there's no conflict, and maybe if I go take a nap, it'll all go away. If you operate that way, you're not living a realistic life. Peace and quiet and rest is going to be in heaven someday. We are living in a time where the Genesis 3 hangover affects every one of us every day. And if that's true, then I can't avoid conflict. Conflict is just part of everyday life. Now, everybody has conflict management. Some people manage conflict by just avoiding conflict. That's the way they manage conflict. What you should be hearing is that's not a biblical way to manage conflict. What you should be hearing is that we're called to respond to conflict in a way that's remarkably different than the world. And that starts with glorifying God, then getting the log out of your own eye, then moving toward other people, gently restoring, always with the goal of go and be reconciled. Let's keep going. And as you can tell, I'm only going to do the first G, so we're going to have to do three G's during the second session. Let's look at the next page. How do you discern what's going on in the heart? So We call these heart themes or worship themes. You'll just have to write this down the margin, and I'm going to overwhelm you here. Whoops, let me go back one. There we go. You don't have to write all this down because I've already given you some of the definitions, but the heart, the idea of the heart biblically is your mind, your affections, or I use the word emotions. Affections is a more technical word. Your decision making. So why do I make the decisions that I do? Like I decide not to talk about an issue that's bothering me. Well, why do you clam up? Well, that's telling you something about your heart. There's something you value in your heart that you decide it's better to just clam up. Sometimes that can be good. That can be a godly thing to do, but many people clam up and it's not a godly thing to do. It just lets things fester if you don't resolve them. Notice the last one. This is a really important one. What am I hungry for? My appetites. And what am I driven for? My passions. And let's use some counseling type of ideas here. Some people can really be hungry, appetites can be hungry for approval. And then you get into a conflict situation, and if you're really hungry for approval, how do you tend to deal with conflict? Well, I can think of a lot of different scenarios. I might say the things that I want other people to hear because I want them to think highly of me, instead of telling them what's really going on in my heart. Or I'm afraid of what the other person will think, so I'm not going to talk at all. Or I'm really, another. On the other hand, you might have somebody say, I'm really hungry, I feel hunger, I really feel compelled to keep my life under control and structured. Well, how can those people be with people, other people sometimes? Life's about structure, life's about control. Well, they can tend to dominate conversations. And you just put it together here, a husband and wife, and you have one who is on the people-pleasing side of things, and that person's running from the conflict. And then on the other side, you have maybe a wife that's more on the controlling side of things, and the husband's wanting to clam up, and he's wanting to leave the conflict. And she's kind of saying, come back here and fight like a man, because she's more on the controlling side of things. That's the heart. We're all living with a Genesis 3 hangover, and what you should be hearing is that the Lord wants to change us from the inside out so that we can approach conflict as an act of worship, so that whether we eat or drink or whatever we do all to the glory of God. Or Matthew 22, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And because I love the Lord more than I love my people pleasing, or because I love the Lord more than I love my control tendencies, I'm going to do things His way instead of my way. And if you start approaching conflict like that, you're going to start seeing a difference in the way you handle tensions in relationships. Now, here's what we're going to do each time, is we're going to read that statement. And this is what we call the Peacemaker's Pledge. So these four G's have a summary paragraph that goes with them. And one of the things I do with parties that are in conflict when they're sitting in my office is that we read the Peacemaker's Pledge together. So each time that we cover a G, we will read part of it. And what I'd like you to do is read out loud with me. And we'll start with the word instead. So are you with me? Let's read this together. Instead of focusing on our own desires or dwelling on what others may do, we will seek to please and honor God by depending on His wisdom, power, and love, by faithfully obeying His commands, and by seeking to maintain a loving, merciful, and forgiving attitude. All those things glorify God. Let me finish, then we get to go eat, and the food smells really good. I'll finish with a story just to encourage you and keep this real. So at the Shepherd's Conference a number of years ago, because I was known at Master's College and Seminary as the conflict resolution guy, I hardly ever got to go into any sessions at the Shepherd's Conference. So pastors would come up to me and say, hey, do you have a minute? I knew exactly what that meant. So this pastor came up to me that I knew. He worked in the Southwest with the Navajo Indians. And I had done some ministry with them, teaching on the Navajo Reservation. And he, I said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "You have a minute?" I went, "Okay, this is going to be interesting." He said, "Actually, not too good. My elders just asked me to take a sabbatical. My wife committed adultery, and she's, imagine this, he's the pastor, and his wife is under church discipline from the church that he was pastoring. Can you imagine? Just heartbreaking, even talking about it." He said, "So my wife and I are trying to get reconciled. My wife's under discipline. Would you help us?" And so I said, "Give me a little bit of time to think about it," because I had to think through my schedule. I knew what that, if I were going to buy into this, it was going to take some time, because it was going to be two things. It was going to be helping them with their marriage and getting reconciled, and it was going to be helping the church and her get reconciled and her deal with the adultery issues. And she was already, the Lord was already working in her heart. So after a few days of praying about it, I agreed to help them, and we started doing counseling regularly by Skype. And it was two things. I was working with them, and then I was working with the elders of the church of how can you tell if real, the main issue was how do you tell if real repentance has taken place, and that's what I was working with the elders on. And to make a long story shorter, their marriage was mended beautifully. She repented. They worked on reconciliation, and she stood before the congregation. The pastor's wife stood before the congregation and humbled herself before the congregation. She used a tool that we call the 7 A's of confession, which you'll find in the book The Peacemaker or Peacemaking for Families. And she read a beautiful confession, and then the congregation forgave her, and she was restored to fellowship. And I wear a ring. If you know anything about the Navajo Indians, you know, they do a lot with silver and turquoise. And they gave me this ring as a thank you gift for helping them get reconciled and helping her get reconciled to the church. So I wear this as a reminder of the very principles that we're talking about, that this is not just theoretical. This is exactly what works. And the first step of helping people get reconciled is you got to get the needle pointed right, that life's about the glory of God. And this tension in your life is not a mistake. Nothing comes into my life unless it comes through the hand of God first. So the first question then is, how do I glorify God? Or how can I approach this conflict as an act of worship? So after we eat and everybody's groggy, I'll cover 3 more G's. And we'll try to get those all fit in the second hour.